The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, greetings from the nation's capital, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Capital Thinking. It's been 4 months since President Barack Obama was in Denver and signed the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, better known as the Economic Stimulus Package. We see signs of some nascent recovery in the American economy, and we're going to spend much of today visiting three key areas that were covered in the Economic Stimulus Package to talk about their impact so far and what you may need to know about how to take advantage of opportunities still present from those sectors. We're going to talk about energy, talk a little bit about communications, telecommunications, and then also talk about transportation and infrastructure. We'll wind up our day with some of the hot topics from the Hill this week. But first up is our friend and frequent contributor here to Capital Thinking, Josh Green from the law firm of Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C., to talk about energy issues. Josh, how are you today?
I'm good, Kevin. How are you?
Hey, listen, let's. I want to get into the economic stimulus measures involving the Economic Recovery Act that had to do with energy. But first, tell me what's going on with cap and trade on the Hill this week before we get into the Recovery Act.
Oh, sure thing, Kevin. The House Democrats, through a series of hearings and long and labored proceedings, are attempting to move a cap and trade bill, a greenhouse gas emissions limitation bill, to the House floor next week, and it's proving to be a challenge for a variety of reasons. The bill not only includes what would be a national or federal cap and trade program for a variety of greenhouse gases, the most common one being CO2, carbon dioxide, but it also has within it a number of energy policy related provisions that are proving somewhat controversial, including a federal renewable electricity standard, amongst others. And as you can imagine, there is a lot of disagreement both within the Democratic caucus, let alone amongst the Republicans. And one of the unique things about energy policy in the United States of America is that oftentimes energy policy cuts across party lines, and it always cuts across regional lines within the United States. You can imagine that the coasts, both the East Coast and the West Coast, have a much different vision of energy policy than, let's say, the Midwest or certainly the Rocky Mountain West. So all of these things are factoring into what is really a skirmish going on Capitol Hill. Whether or not Speaker Pelosi makes her goal of moving to a House floor vote next, as early as next week, is yet to be seen. There are still some battles going on, but we feel pretty confident that before the summer is out, and certainly perhaps on the other side of the long summer recess, that the House, the full House, will be taking a vote on the cap and trade bill.
Very good. Well, in the meantime, they're expelling lots of CO2 trying to get there to the consensus. Well, let's talk a little bit about the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. They had a lot in there, Josh, to do with both alternative energy and even traditional forms of energy to sort of jumpstart some of the president's plans. Can you start with maybe a summary of what was in that bill that passed 4 months ago for the energy sector?
Certainly. The big number there is $80 billion, essentially, which has been will be rather administered through the Economic Recovery Act. A large chunk of that will be in the form of what we in the energy sector know as the Department of Energy's Loan Guarantee Program. But there is quite a bit of money that has also gone out in the form of grants to the states, the Energy Efficiency Conservation Block Grant Program, to be precise, as well as the State Energy Program and Weatherization Assistance. That totals probably in the neighborhood of $6 to $7 billion. There was another large chunk of money that was appropriated for a smart grid, and this is the application of making our national electric distribution system smarter in terms of the way in which energy, and more precisely electric energy, is used. There's a $4.5 billion pot there. Some of that money has already been announced in funding opportunities for what are called smart grid demonstration projects that both utilities and municipalities can enter into. And then there is a series of additional programs that will be mostly administered out of the Department of Energy's laboratory network for a variety of energy applications, including advanced battery manufacturing technology, vehicle technology, energy storage, industrial energy efficiency, as well as transformative and breakthrough technology investments. And then finally ending up with another large chunk having to do with what is commonly referred to in the energy debate as clean coal, and the funding of carbon capture and sequestration. Most of the money still hasn't been dispersed, which is probably often the case in Washington.
I've been reading Tom Friedman's Flat, Hot, and Crowded, his bestseller follow-up to his book, The World is Flat. And he spends a lot of time talking about the need to transform the electric grid into a smarter system, and it seems like this smart grid is along those lines, or a first step along those lines. Tell me a little bit more about what's going on with smart grid, what it does, and what its status is.
Sure. In 2007, the Congress passed, and then President Bush enacted into law a bill called the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007. Title 13 of that bill set forth a variety of policies relating to smart grid. And essentially, smart grid, in a nutshell, is how the electric distribution system will communicate with energy users, both in your home, your thermostat, your appliances, as well as commercial and industrial facilities like the power plant down the street or the manufacturing facility up the road, all in an effort to make improvements in how electricity is used and distributed, or what is commonly referred to as energy efficiency. The less energy we use, the more need to build power plants, and we can cut our emissions, what have you. So in along these lines, the Department of Energy has issued two funding opportunities related to smart grid, and that $4.5 billion number that I alluded to earlier is where most of that money is coming from. And it is in the form of grants that applicants will be able to use to implement so-called smart grid projects. These are things such as advanced meters, or what we call smart meters, that would be placed in people's homes that would register the amount of energy and in real time would transfer that data back to the utilities so that utilities would have a better handle on what level of energy is being used in houses or industrial facilities. There's also going to be an IT component who has software that can help utilities and residential and commercial owners use their energy better. The upper level argument here and policy rationale for smart grid goes back to something I just referred to, and that is we know that energy demand is going to rise into the future. So the question becomes, we only have so much land and so much space and so much ability to build power plants. So we need to be more efficient with the way we use electricity. And smart grid will go a long way in helping those lines. And I think, you know, Tom Friedman is one of those champions out there. There are a lot of companies that are doing very innovative and progressive things along these lines.
Let me hit one more topic, and we got about 2 minutes left.
Sure.
Josh, tell me about this mysterious ARPA-E program and the funding they have available. I hear they have thousands of applicants for lots of money, but a very competitive program over a new program over at DOE.
Oh, sir, great question, Kevin. ARPA-E, which stands for Advanced Research Project Agency Energy, is a new program that's modeled after the Department of Defense program called DARPA. And essentially, what ARPA-E is designed to do is make what we would call kind of seed capital investments to both public and private entities or joint partnerships that are looking at innovative or transformative or breakthrough technologies in the energy space that otherwise couldn't get private capital. The program was authorized in 2007 but not yet funded, and then President Obama and the Democrats decided to fund the program in the recovery bill to the tune of $400 million. You alluded to a funding opportunity that's out. That is correct. There is a funding opportunity that is out. It closed last couple of weeks ago regarding an initial funding awards of $20 million. There were, and you were right on the money on that, Kevin, slightly over 1,000 applications were submitted. The Department of Energy, through its National Lab Network, are going to be reviewing those applications, and sometime in July, at this point, I think the date is July 15th, 16th, around there, the Department of Energy will be communicating to those applicants whether or not their application will move to the next level of potential funding awards.
Interesting. Well, Josh, appreciate having you on. I know we have some folks who probably want to make contact with you to talk about how to get into the game for energy issues. Why don't you give us hit us with your email address so people can follow up with you?
Oh, certainly. Would love to. The email address is jgreene, J-G-R-E-E-N-E, at Patton Boggs, all one word, PattonBoggs.com, and I'd be more than happy to answer any additional questions.
Great. We'll have Josh back on to update folks on energy issues sometime later this summer. We're going to be back in just a moment. We're going to next talk about telecommunications, but for right now, you're listening to Capital Thinking here on Voice America Business Network.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Parents, did you know that high school dropouts make 42% less than graduates? Someone will have to make up that difference, and chances are, that will be you. That means paying 42% of their groceries.
Ooh, more candy.
42% of their dentist bills.
No more candy.
Even 42% of their therapy sessions.
It's all my dad's fault.
Save your money. Encourage your kids to stay in school. For help and advice, call 877-FORA-KID. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Have
having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Pat and Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Pat and Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Pat and Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Pat and Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Pat and Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattenboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattenboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, my friends, Kevin O'Neill back with you here on Capital Thinking. A terrific day here in the nation's capital. Not too hot, not too sunny. Maybe even one of the last dying days of spring before the dog days of summer. But as always, a challenging time in Washington, D.C. Getting ready for the show today. I had my iPod fired up here in the office, reading through what's going on in Washington, D.C., a variety of publications. And a Springsteen song came on, reminded me sort of what Obama's got going, and that's working on a dream. This guy is working on six or seven major priorities at any given time, and he sure seems to be biting off an awful lot. And you start to see perhaps now the beginnings of a backlash against the president's agenda. For those of you who watched the morning news this morning, the Today Show had a poll out that showed the president's popularity has declined relatively precipitously in just the last 60 days, particularly among independents. And when you look at some of the questions deeper into the poll, it seems like independents in particular are dissatisfied with the ongoing intervention of government into the inner workings of our nation's economy, things like the GM bailout, which have occurred since last NBC polled. And then you look at some of the things that the president is doing, and you wonder if he's not setting himself up for a pretty significant series of failures here the next couple months. I think President Obama is either setting himself up for some spectacular strings of successes in the next 6 months here in Congress, or a couple of pretty big, high-profile failures. I'll give you an example. Yesterday, the president came out, spent all day sort of thumping a new regulatory system for the financial services world. And this is the latest salvo in an effort to rebuild confidence in the economic system, rebuild confidence in Wall Street and our banking institutions, and to regulate places where we've had problems. And I think most Americans think, all right, we've had problems. Let's fix those problems. Let's make sure it doesn't happen again. That seems to make some sense, but then the president looks like he overreaches because he wants to put in things like a consumer protection agency at the federal level that will have jurisdiction over any financial product that you can think of. And you say, boy, that seems like an awful lot. Isn't that what state government does? Where is the role in the Constitution for the feds to regulate every last product that we have? Of course, interstate commerce is a big issue and something that's well litigated at the federal level, but there's also that 10th Amendment that says the things not expressly given to the federal government are reserved for the rights of the states. And by and large, if you look at what's happened in our financial world, what has crumbled has been issues where the federal government has primary responsibility. You don't see, it wasn't the states that signed off on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and it wasn't the states that signed off on mortgage guidelines that allowed anybody to basically walk in and say that they had the income necessary to get the home of their dreams and walk out with a balloon mortgage that that with a teaser rate that would go up in a few months and they wouldn't be able to pay that off. That's not a state problem. Those are things that happen at the federal level. So you wonder, why is the president overreaching? And I think you see the reaction from both sides of the aisle in the 24 hours since the president came up with that. You see there's been a lot of pushback on the president, and a lot of people who are saying, slow down, you know, let's separate the things that have to be done, which is fixing the regulatory system at the federal level versus the things that are not even want to get done but are sort of wish list items for the president, like this new consumer protection agency. I mean, we already have a hodgepodge, an alphabet soup, to quote Chuck Schumer, senator from New York, an alphabet soup of items, the SEC, all kinds of other entities, the FTC, that regulate various financial products, and to layer on another addition instead of fixing what we already have seems like a strange way to go for the president. It'll be interesting to see how he prevails and how he gets through this legislative traffic jam that in many ways he's created for himself. The president's rhetoric has been very ambitious. The last few months he's demanded that Congress get done with health care reform and with cap and trade that we were just talking with Josh about in the last segment, and he wants that done by the end of July. And Congress doesn't move very quickly. They, frankly, don't have much time left before the end of July. And here we are. Health care reform right now has barely been introduced in the relevant committees in the House and Senate. One of the two Senate committees that looks at it is delaying their consideration of marking up their part of the bill until at least next week. Meanwhile, the other Senate committee, the HELP committee, has got hundreds of amendments that have been offered to the bill, and they're going to have to work their way through that. That's probably going to take them a couple weeks of markup before they emerge with something. The House is getting cranked up as well and getting ready to get down to business on marking up their health care reform bill. But the big issue, and again, the president sort of created this problem, is cost. The Congressional Budget Office, which is sort of this nonpartisan entity that's supposed to, quote-unquote, score things and tell us how much would it cost to make these changes, how much money in new taxes would have to be imposed or budget cuts elsewhere would have to be imposed in order to get this done. And they came out with some stunning numbers. One plan's $1 trillion over 10 years. Another plan is $1.6 trillion over 10 years. And those are staggering numbers that would require massive new tax increases or severe reductions in other domestic spending areas, or yet more deficit spending. And I think for a lot of Americans, those are that's not a list of attractive options. And why have we gotten to that point? Well, again, the president seems to have been overreaching in his ambitions here for a legislative agenda. Right now, the president could walk into Congress and get a bill passed in very short order to solve the problem that he campaigned on last year, and that is ensure 47 million Americans who don't have access to insurance today. I think that battle is won in the halls of Congress. The question is, how do you cover them? But when you look at the bills that are being introduced, not only are they trying to cover the people that have that don't have coverage, they're also trying in many ways to shift people who have private insurance onto the rolls of a so-called public option. I know one of the studies that was released last week actually said more people would shift under the Ted Kennedy plan that's been introduced. More people would shift from the rolls of private insurance to a public option under that plan than would get off the list of people who don't have insurance and now get this public option. So that seems to have it backwards. If the idea is to get people insurance, that should be what we're focused on in this bill, getting everybody covered, not getting everybody covered by a preferred provider that that the government is directing us to, be they public or private. We should have lots of options. Health care reform is going to be just a tremendous challenge for this president in the next couple months, especially because he set some artificial timelines. He said he wants a bill on his desk by October 15th. Congressional Democrats have enacted budget reconciliation rules that allow them to fast-track a bill later this fall if, in fact, their efforts to get something done this summer in a bipartisan fashion fail. A lot of people on the Hill will tell you they think that the way the rules have been set up and the way this debate is proceeding, that parties on both sides aren't trying to cut a deal. They're trying to create a confrontation around that budget reconciliation process this fall, and that perhaps the majority may be able to just jam through the provisions that they want in the fall. And I've spent some time in the last couple of weeks speaking with some people on the Senate side and the minority that I respect and have a pretty sophisticated understanding of what's going on here, and they see healthcare reform as a win-win situation in many ways for them. First, they're hoping to defeat this public option, and if they defeat the public option, then they've got a great issue to take to the polls and talk about how their minority should be larger because they preserved everybody's private insurance. If they don't win on public option, then they get to go. They get to lay the blame entirely at the feet of the Democrats if consumers discover that what the government has created here is actually worse than what we have now. And that's certainly the big fear among some moderate Democrats is that the medicine here is worse than the illness. Instead of trying to cover folks that need coverage, we're trying to fix a lot of problems at once. Now, I will give President Obama a lot of credit. For those of you who – I'm a big Harry Potter fan at my house. We're reading the six-year-old boy all the Harry Potter novels in order. And we're reading a book this month about – we're talking about the game of Quidditch, and there's a move called the Ronsky feint. And it's basically where one of the players takes off and looks like they're going after an objective, and at the last minute they swerve away because the objective was all just a feint that kept the defense off guard while they moved in on their primary objective. And that's what I think President Obama might have going on here. This might all be a big feint. He's gotten Congress and especially congressional Republicans all worked up about whether or not a public option will be the be-all, end-all. And the Republican minority and their interest groups are working so hard to oppose a public option that they'd be willing to cave in on almost any other issue that's in this massive bill that will change about 17 or 18% of our economy, the entire healthcare sector of the economy, just so that they could say they won the public option battle. So if that's the president's agenda, boy, he's doing a tremendous job because he's going to get lots of changes in the final bill, and he'll give up something that perhaps he intended to give up all along. Some leadership elections to talk about in the House and the Senate. Sort of jumping jacks, moving around, shuffling of the deck with the Republicans started when John McHugh took the Secretary of the Army position and opened up a ranking member position on armed services. That position on armed services was filled last week by the ranking Republican on the House Education Labor Committee. So this week there was an election to fill that. Interestingly, I think big strategic error made by congressional Republicans. They chose John Klein, a longtime member from the state of Minnesota, to be the ranking member of that committee, picked him over Kathy McMorris Rogers, a woman who's perhaps the biggest female leader of the Republicans in the House. And for a party that wants to try and get back in the majority, they're making a huge mistake by not offering some of these leadership positions to folks like McMorris Rogers to show American women that women have a strong voice in the Republican Party. So lots of interesting things going on with that. We'll talk a little more in just a minute. We're going to be back talking telecommunications stimulus in just a moment.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Markaba.
From Denver to
Hello.
Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. Our topic now is telecommunications issues related to the economic stimulus. In particular, the development of rural broadband is going to be our focus. And our guests in this segment are Mark Ellison. He's the Senior Vice President and General Counsel for the National Rural Telecommunications Cooperative. They're a nonprofit group that provides advanced telecommunications services and technology to rural America. And they work with more than 1,400 rural utilities in 48 states in our great nation. We're also joined by Jennifer Richter, who is the chairman of the Telecommunications Policy Group at the law firm of Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C. And she's a regular on the show. But, Mark, this is your maiden voyage on Capital Thinking, so welcome to the show. And why don't you tell us a little bit about the National Rural Telecommunications Cooperative and your mission.
No, thank you, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here. NRTC has been around since 1986. We were formed by the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association and the Cooperative Finance Corporation with the purpose of bringing advanced telecommunications out to rural markets. And initially in 1986, the original focus was on television service, and NRTC became one of the first, if not the first, independent packager of television programming, which we delivered out to the big C-band dish market. In the early 1990s, our members invested over $100 million in DirecTV, bought exclusive territories in rural markets, and we ultimately delivered about 2 million DirecTV subscribers into the market. We've gotten into a lot of new businesses since then. We provide smart grid applications for our electric utilities. We have we're a cellular reseller, and most recently, in the past couple of years, we've gotten involved in broadband. Going back to 2003-2004, we made an investment in Wild Blue Satellite, providing two-way satellite internet. We now have about 80,000 rural home subscribers on Wild Blue. And more recently, in fact, just in the past couple of months, we've been looking for some new ways to reach rural markets beyond the satellite, and WiMAX seemed to be the right fit for the rural market, and we discovered this great company just down the road, and we're in Herndon, Virginia, and these folks were down in Ashburn, just down the road from us, and it's called Digital Bridge Communication.
Yeah, let's talk about this. First, let me say, I love the names in the telecommunications sector, Wild Blue, Digital Bridge. No Procter & Gamble's for you guys. You just have these sexy names that you must have paid a lot, you know, marketing companies a lot to come up with.
Well, we're pretty generic with National Rural Telecommunications Cooperative.
Well, you guys are old enough. You didn't think that in the 80s you probably needed a sexy name like Wild Blue, which sounds like you know, great stuff. But let's talk a little bit. I know you have made a substantial investment in partnership with Digital Bridge, and they're a WiMAX operator. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that deal, how this relationship is benefiting your members across the country?
Well, it's we took an equity position with Digital Bridge. Feet on the board, and we also have entered into a distribution agreement with them. And it's really very much in its infancy right now. We have reached out to our members and have gotten just a tremendous response from both our telephone cooperative members as well as our electric co-op members. And we are proceeding to put together a plan to go out into the market with Digital Bridge. and our members and work with the stimulus program that's available to our members. So it's early on. We have not launched yet. Digital Bridge is currently in 15 markets. Something we really liked about them is that they're up, they're operational. This is not vaporware. It's an operating WiMAX system that can be rapidly deployed in our rural markets and very effectively deployed at costs of about $50 or $60 per home passed, which is very cost effective compared to fiber build. Our members have done a great job out there, particularly the telcos, of getting DSL and fiber out into the market. But there was a Pew study that came out just yesterday showing that only 46% of rural households have broadband at this point. So obviously we've got to keep looking for new ways to get out there, and we'll work with our members to extend the reach that they've already accomplished out there in these markets.
Great. Well, let me bring Jennifer in here a minute. We're going to come back to you, Mark. But, Jennifer, I know you have been quarterbacking the firm's efforts on what's going on, broadband stimulus and the economic recovery package. Tell us a little bit about the latest and greatest there. When is this money going to get out the door to various entities across the country?
Sure, you bet. And just to follow on what Mark just said, cost-effective solutions to bringing broadband everywhere that it's needed is really going to be the name of the game, because $7.2 billion sounds like a lot, but when it comes down to actual deployments of this broadband infrastructure, it's going to be expensive, and it's going to be especially expensive in sparsely populated areas where NRTC and DBC are particularly focused. So it's great to have a solution like WiMAX that can get that broadband service out there cost-effectively. So the timing is really now on broadband stimulus. And so for any of your listeners who are interested in it, it really is time to gear up and to start to get ready for applications. We are expecting the notice of funds availability to come out from NTIA and RUS, which will be a joint notice by the end of this month, June 30th. There was some scuttlebutt in Washington, D.C. this week that it could come out a little earlier, maybe even next week, but I don't think that's correct. I think it'll be end of June, could even be early into July. The window for filing applications, we believe, will be in the July-August timeframe. Again, maybe slipping a little if the NOFA comes out a little bit late. With applications then, starting to be processed by NTIA and RUS in September, and then perhaps we'll have our first grants of broadband stimulus funding coming out in December. There'll be two more windows. One should be toward the end of this year, somewhere in the October to December timeframe, and another one in the spring. So there's a lot going on. There's certainly a lot that is already known about what your application needs to look like and sound like coming from the stimulus bill, the conference report, the OMB guidance that's come out so far. So it's not too early to get going, even though we don't have the official notice of funds availability available to us yet.
Well, Mark, let's come back to you. You guys are big players on behalf of your members in searching out broadband stimulus funding that you can bring to give access to people in rural areas across America. Tell us your vision about how these funds can best be put to use now or in the future, and what kind of projects your association, the cooperatives, considering putting in for.
Well, first and foremost is getting the applications in for the Digital Bridge projects. It appears that between NRTC and Digital Bridge, which will have some of its own applications in markets where we don't have members, we may have somewhere anywhere between 50 and 100 applications in the first round. So we're very busy right now and focused on that. As Jennifer said, I think that what we bring is something that can be done that really meets the objectives of the stimulus. That is very quick to market. We can deploy this within 6 to 9 months of getting the green light. It's very inexpensive to deploy, very cheap and easy for the consumer. It's a small, for the indoor antenna, very small little box they just carry home, plug in, and it's immediately authorized, and they connect that to their computer directly or can do an internal Wi-Fi system. And that serves areas outside of about 2 to 3 miles from the base station or the tower. And then using a small outdoor antenna, the service can reach out about 7 or 8 miles. So a single tower, depending on the terrain, can cover about 90 square miles. And it's very inexpensive, very easy for the consumer, which is very important in our markets. We don't have the levels of income that some communities and areas of the country have. So that was an important factor as we searched things out. We're also looking at the new satellite offerings that we think will be coming down the road with much faster speeds, and we think there's always a place for the two-way satellite because fiber, DSL, WiMAX is not going to cover everything satellite does, and so we keep that as a very important element in what we're offering in the rural markets.
Jennifer, let me come back to you. We got about 2 minutes left here. Tell me a little bit about the big issues looming out there on broadband stimulus policy. I know there are things like Buy American regulations that seem to be a little bit tricky for some of the players trying to get involved here.
Sure. I mean, I think the big question marks for all of us right now are how the FCC is going to define unserved and underserved. What will be sort of minimum thresholds for broadband, what those, you know, interconnection and non-discrimination obligations might be. And the FCC is coordinating that directly with NTIA and RUS, and we're not getting a heads up about what those definitions might be before the NOFA comes out. So that has us all a little bit on pins and needles. The other, I think, big issue in the industry right now, and that is the subject of a lot of debate and will be the subject of comments that are filed on Monday with the Office of Management and Budget, is the Buy American issue, as you mentioned. The stimulus bill requires that any recovery funds that are used for construction of infrastructure for public works, which could include broadband infrastructure, must use that money to buy iron, steel, and manufactured goods that are domestic or that are deemed domestic because of certain trade agreements that we have. And for the broadband industry, many of our components and technology are manufactured elsewhere, a lot in China, for example, and China, India, and Brazil don't have trade agreements with us, and so they don't qualify for Buy American status. And so if that's the case, it's not that those products can't be used as part of a broadband infrastructure play, but they have to be priced at least 25% below an equivalent domestic or deemed domestic product. So that's a really big issue. And companies like Alcatel-Lucent and Cisco have been very vocal about that and that perhaps there should be a favor of American for broadband stimulus. I expect they'll be filing on Monday. And there are companies on the other side of that make WiMAX equipment like Alvarion, who qualifies, they're an Israeli manufacturer, they qualify for Buy American. Yeah. Pure Wave, who actually is manufactured here in the United States, who qualify and, you know, really, really want to be able to command a lot of this marketplace for themselves. So it's a very interesting competitive issue. It's getting a lot of visibility, not only in our industry, but also with
representatives. We're going to have to leave it there. We'll be back in just a moment with more Capital Thinking.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to the show. We promised today that we would talk about three big issues related to the economic stimulus bill and its fourth month of implementation. We talked about energy already and now telecommunications in our last segment. And now we're going to talk about transportation and infrastructure. A lot of activity going on up on the Hill and in the administration related to that. And our guest at this moment is Norma Kraham, who's a former Chief of Staff for the United States Department of Transportation under the Clinton administration, and now is a senior advisor at the law firm of Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C., where she works on transportation issues. Norma, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Kevin.
Well, tell me, I know there's a frantic amount of activity going on in transportation, even just today on the Hill. Tell me the latest and greatest about reauthorization of highway and transit programs.
Thanks, Kevin. You're right. It's actually a really exciting day for transportation and infrastructure in the U.S. We have all been holding our breath, waiting for the release of a bill from Chairman Oberstar in the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. That release was initially planned for yesterday. I think with some last-minute editing and other things, was pushed off to today. What we're seeing is really a blueprint from Chairman Oberstar and Ranking Member Micah on what they're calling investment and reform. And I think that really what's important today is that they're talking about the need to evolve from what have been mid-1950s policies really to a 21st century infrastructure system. The interesting piece to add to that is that the administration late last night announced that they have their own bill. The difference, however, is that while Oberstar is looking at a six-year bill, the administration is now recommending an 18-month bill that they say is fully paid for. And the paid-for components are something of much debate at the moment on how we're going to get there and what really needs to be done.
Yes, very curious. Just exactly how are they paying for it?
Well, you know what's amazing is that we still have not yet seen those parameters. I know Secretary LaHood was testifying this morning before the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Transportation, where he was to unveil really what the vision piece was, and I haven't had a chance to take a look at that. You know, the very basics of the pay-for, we've always talked about, have been the gas tax and other things, and the Obama administration has been very clear in this economy. They don't believe the gas tax is the right way to go.
Yeah, the gas tax, you know, the gas tax seems like one of those things that at the end of the day, everybody says they don't want to raise it, but it hasn't been raised in, 20 years. The need to raise it, its purchasing power has gone down so much, I don't see at the end of the day how they get a deal with the numbers they want without doing something like that. But, well, tell us a little bit about, I know there's also some movement. We've been talking on the stimulus here earlier in the program, that there's some movement on the Tiger or Tigger program, depending on how you want to pronounce it. That's $1.5 billion of funding available for major transportation projects across the country. Tell us what's going on there.
Well, that's another fabulous program that came out of the stimulus. And for the first time ever, that grant program focuses very heavily on intermodal projects. And whereas before, funding, as our listeners may know, can be very stovepiped. It's a highway. It's a bridge. What the administration is looking for is projects of regional and national significance. Projects requests are really applications for the discretionary grant program are due September 15th. And I think, at least from what we're hearing on the street, there's a lot of interest there that this really is pushing, forcing, or bringing communities along to focus on greater intermodal projects. And another big component is that ports who don't have a dedicated funding source are included in this piece. So I think we're going to see a systems approach. And probably the best of all the worst-case scenarios for the agency is they may have more applications than they know what to do with, and that may mean decision-making will be challenging, but hopefully good projects will come out of that process.
Yeah, it's one of the more unique federal programs where the minimum you can get is $20 million. That's a pretty nice minimum for a transportation project or a project of any kind in this day and age.
And with that's exactly right, and with a cap of $300 million. So if I were any communities, I'd be thrilled for anything in between.
Yeah, you could probably make some things happen. Well, let's talk a little bit about the politics of what's going on up there on the Hill with the reauthorization. Seems to be a lot of back and forth between Jim Oberstar, who's the Democratic chairman of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, and sort of his vision for the next few months in getting this reauthorization bill. That differs from Barbara Boxer, who's the chairman of Environment and Public Works, which has most of the control, but not all the control, over the Senate side reauthorization, and the president's vision via Secretary of Transportation LaHood.
That's exactly right. I mean, as Oberstar has stated in the last at least several months, he's very focused on trying to bring a reauthorization bill to the House floor and to actually get it completed by the time that the bill expires September 30th. The Senate side, Senator Boxer, the chair, as you mentioned, has a number of other issues on her plate, global climate change and other pieces. And generally, there's been a discussion that bill really needs to simply be extended, and we'll finish it up next year. Interestingly, when the administration announced the fact that they did have a bill, and we're all anxious to see what that is, the Senate really, supported the administration, and you have many other folks who are saying, no way, no how, not an 18-month short-term bill. We want a full six-year, $458 million bill. So the politics are going to be interesting. It's unclear if there has been coordination between the administration and the Democrats in the Congress. Not sure if the late notice last night from Secretary LaHood made it all the way up to at least the House in time. And so we're going to have to see how some of that shakes out. I think it is an interesting approach. I think we all in the transportation community want a strong, vibrant six-year bill that really does meet the needs of our infrastructure. It is crumbling. We do have many challenges. But we do have a problem with the Highway Trust Fund at the moment. And I think, the dynamic
is as bankrupt as the rest of the country.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we're hoping that that's not going to happen. But if they fix that, maybe the interim approach is, short-term bill, then a long one. But I don't think any of that has really panned out enough for us to figure out where we're going to go.
What does that mean for, local transit agencies, cities, state departments, highway departments, as they sort of figure out what to build and when to build it?
And that is really the crux of the matter that we need to hash our way through. If there's a pro to an 18-month bill, it's fix the Highway Trust Fund, get through this economy, and the concerns over the increase of the gas tax and the impacts can be managed and mitigated. The con, of course, is transit communities and everyone else in the transportation world need long-term planning. And that's really what a six-year bill does. Breaking it down into 18 months and then something else, I think, will be very problematic for mid- to long-term planning. And for the projects that are in the queue, how does a state or a local community figure out how to parse out funds if they're really not sure when a bill's going to come?
Well, those are questions we'll have to answer for another day. Norma, thanks for joining us, telling us the latest on transportation reauthorization. We'll be back next week with another exciting hour of policy issues. Until then, you're listening to Capital Thinking here on the Voice America Business Network.
Thank you. for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.